Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you're listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Eric Henriksen. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Physics at Washington University, St. Louis. Thanks for stopping by, Eric.
Oh, really happy to be here. Thanks, Dave.
Now, Eric, you study an interesting class of materials. So tell us a little bit about what that class is and how they're different from the kinds of things that we encounter in our everyday lives.
That's right. So I'm working on a set of materials called 2D materials, or I think the phrase atomically thin materials is really coming into vogue. The reason is what we do is we take bulk layered materials and we isolate a single layer from that. So this is something that can literally be just one atom thick. So that could be graphene is probably the most popular material. People may have heard of this. Its discovery was actually awarded the 2010 Nobel Prize.
Now, it's a subset. It's not. It's a piece. Graphene is a piece of graphite?
Graphene is a piece of graphite. Or maybe another way to say it is that graphite is a layered material made up of many, 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 many sheets of graphene, just like a stack of paper.
What kinds of other examples would there be? I mean, how many different kinds of things like this are there?
It turns out there are thousands of materials that are layered and can be pulled apart. That is that the layers have weak enough interactions that if we go in there, we can actually pull out one single layer from it. Some other examples would be, say, black phosphorus, which is made of phosphorus just the same as on a match head. That's red phosphorus there. If you take that red phosphorus and compress it and heat it, you'll get black phosphorus as a layered material. You can isolate one single sheet that's just single atom thick phosphorus atoms.
And so what kinds of, let's just talk broadly about the class of materials. Usually when people think in a physics way about materials, they think about perhaps insulators, metals, ceramics, various kinds of things. So can these kinds of two-dimensional materials span any broad class of material? I mean, do they have all sorts of different properties or?
Yeah, so far we're finding pretty much if you know how some bulk material behaves, you have some example of some interesting behavior, we think we can find it in 2D materials. It's been a development, so we've been really looking at graphene since about 2005. Other materials have come along and we've been able to find atomically thin superconducting systems like niobium diselenide is a good example. Or we can even pull out individual layers of high temperature superconductors. Things go by the name BISCO. We can find magnets. This has actually been a very interesting development just the past couple of years. People have found single layer thick ferromagnets, things that would stick to your fridge, although you wouldn't be able to see them anymore. There are other materials, antiferromagnets we can find. We have insulators. Hexagonal boron nitride is one of these, which is actually very, very similar to graphene. Kind of the mental image you want to have, actually, if I can back up for graphene, is kind of like molecular chicken wire. It's a
right,
honeycomb
right.
Lattice. You know, it looks like you open up a beehive. It's got that nice honeycomb. But it's just carbon atoms on a honeycomb lattice, all right? And graphene is a conductor. Technically speaking, it's called a semi-metal. We can talk about that later. But if I take graphene and its carbon atoms and replace the carbon with boron and nitrogen atoms, that gives me hexagonal boron nitride. It's also a honeycomb lattice. It's got the same size, the same distance between the atoms as graphene does, but it is an electrical insulator, very strong one, as good as diamond.
Very interesting. Now, with such odd materials, so very, very bizarre, it must truly be difficult to make them. So tell us how difficult it is to make these.
So, you know, the funny thing is before people started making graphene, there was a way of growing materials that people still do called molecular beam epitaxy. Never mind what that actually means, but MBE also stood for million buck engineering. Here, we're not growing graphene in that way. We are literally just taking scotch tape, using it to pull graphite apart, which is a fairly weak material. You can think of graphite as a lubricant. The layers slide past each other. So we take graphite, put it on scotch tape, press the tape together, peel it apart, press it together, peel it apart, do this numerous times, and you end up spreading that graphite all over the tape. You press this down onto a surface and then peel up the tape again, and you're going to leave a bunch of dirt behind. It's just going to look like a, you know, just a black mess on the surface there. But if you take a good microscope, or heck, even one of those little $10 plastic things from a science museum, and start looking around for the thinnest looking thing on the surface, almost invariably, that's going to be single atom thick graphene.
And then you pull it off with a pair of tweezers or what?
No, we actually play it where it lays.
Oh, okay.
Kind of like golf. Once you peel it off, so we do this onto a thin sheet of glass. We take a silicon wafer with a thin sheet of glass on the surface, and that's what we press the graphite onto, peel it up and cleave off these thin layers. So there'll be some graphene layer down on this wafer, and we tend to just leave it there. Yeah. We actually do have techniques these days that allow us to pick up these single atom thick sheets and move them around and even make sandwiches out of them with other materials. But the easiest thing to do is just leave it there, attach little wires to it where it is. And
so let's talk more about that. You have your own interest. You want to study it now. You want to run some sort of experiments and do things. So the first thing you said is attach little wires. So if I were to hear this, thinking about the chicken wire analogy and thinking about it seems like, boy, it sounds like, since there's nothing supporting it, so to speak, that the typical ways you would bond something to it so that you could actually make a little circuit out of it would destroy the heck out of it. So how do you, is that true or is that a bunch of nonsense?
Yeah, your soldering iron's going to really wreak havoc on these things. So let's get an idea in our head of roughly how big these systems are. Of course, they're one atom thick, which is as thin as you can go and still have something to play with. But in the lateral dimension, so we're thinking like a sheet of paper here. It's one atom thick, but it's got some extent to it, length and width. And typically that's on the order of 10 to 100 microns, millionths of a meter in size. And to give you a sense there, of how big that is, 100 microns is about the diameter of a piece of hair on your head. So we've got this tiny thing about the width of a piece of hair and a single atom thick, and that's our starting point for working with it. To get little wires to attach to that requires some special techniques, and we actually use a scanning electron microscope, which projects a beam of electrons, and we can use that beam of electrons to draw patterns where later we can deposit very fine gold wires. So we end up with gold wires that are anywhere from 1 to 2 or 3 microns. So now that's a hundredth of your hair width, right? About, you know, so 1 micron wide wires touching our little graphene device. Those wires go out to much larger, what we call bond pads that we can actually solder wires to with very tiny soldering irons under a microscope, but we can still do that by hand.
Do you put the grid down before you put the graphene on it, or do you put the grid down after you put the graphene on it?
It depends on the day. It depends on the kind of device we're aiming to make at the end. If we are just working with a single graphene flake, leaving it where it was originally cleaved off, then we will add all of the wires after the fact, because we never know where that graphene flake is going to show up. So you have to go hunt for it, and then you have to make the wires match to it.
How long would that take to make the wires match to it?
The whole process, starting from scotch tape and graphite going through finished device with just graphene and wires attached, is about 2 days.
Well, that's not too bad. 2 days of your work or 2 days of somebody's work?
2 days of somebody's work. Maybe a day and a half if I do it.
Okay, fair enough.
So my questions are good. I'll give them credit.
So now you've got this group of people, and you've got these electrodes attached. And now what will you do with them? You sit them out in air? Are you going to put them in a field of some kind? What happens next?
We're going to do everything we can think of. I mean, the most basic things we like to do with these is, so it's an electrically conducting material. And I should note that the way that graphene conducts electricity is highly unusual. It actually looks like a miniature version of particle physics going on in there. The electrons move around as if they have no mass, which is a very strange thing. So we want to just measure how these electrons are moving. So with the wires attached, we basically hook a battery up to it. We push little electrical currents through, and then we measure the voltages that appear. So just imagine taking a little, you know, voltage multimeter in there and measuring the voltages that appear. Now, we do this at low temperatures so that there's kind of no fluctuations in the measurements due to it being warm. And so we want to get rid of that. We want to see the intrinsic behavior of the material. And then sometimes we'll apply very, very strong magnetic fields, which more or less make the electrons spin in really, really, really tiny circles. And we can see these effects in the measurements that we're making.
Now, you say you make something like a few micron piece. And so it's supposed to be pristine, whatever, not graphene, but whatever it is you're working on. How does it have a lot of broken bonds and naughty atoms that shouldn't be there and stuff? Is it, we would call these typically defects. Is it defect ridden or defect free, or are there any reasonable criteria that have to be established?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting area of graphene research. So typically, these little graphene flakes that cleave off, single atom thick, are perfect little crystals. Except at the edge, there'll have to be some dangling bonds, but they tend to cleave along nice axes, what we call the zigzag and armchair edges, which just has to do with the pattern of carbon atoms at the edge. But typically, these will cleave right on edges, and you'll get some nice little, maybe not honeycomb-shaped flake, but there will be nice angles at the edge. Now, in the interior of this, where it's just, you know, this sheet of carbon atoms, graphene is almost always perfect. It's extremely rare to find a missing atom. It is just not something graphene likes to do, is lose any of its atoms. Now, there have been some fun experiments where people have taken graphene, suspended it, so imagine like the thinnest little drum head ever, and then they fire a powerful electron beam at it, and they knock out some of those carbon atoms. And you can make these tiny little holes, and the holes are initially ragged. And then as you watch it in a scanning electron microscope, they actually heal themselves. They don't close up. You'd have to add atoms to do that. But you go from a ragged hole to one that has really nice crystalline facets on it.
Now, there's no possibility you can induce regularity in the defect structure, is there?
You can get close. You could imagine punching holes on a regular lattice, trying to see what that does
because
to the material.
Because the bonds can shift and move around, and so you could reorder.
They can. Yep. So you have to make the holes large enough. Then it becomes less likely for them to move.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. So now you find out all these various kinds of things, and you're studying magnetic properties and conductivity and this and that and the other thing. And ultimately, you might want to try to make a device out of it, or somebody might want to. So the next step, let's say you learn a lot about the physics and you find something that's promising and so forth. Then what kinds of things are people going to make out of this? Are they going to make what you typically call the stock in trade for electronic devices? I mean, they're going to make those kinds of things like transistors and stuff. What will you make out of this?
Yeah, early on, everyone kind of looked to graphene like, oh, this is really going to, you know, save our technological evolution, make better microchips and so forth. There is kind of a problem that you cannot make standard transistors with graphene. That's because it's extremely difficult to shut off its electrical conductivity. However, this isn't such a problem for, say, high-frequency or microwave circuits that are used in some certain applications. So graphene might show up there. It probably, in the long run, is going to work better as some sort of sensor. Graphene is one atom thick. There is no volume to it. It is entirely surface. Anything that lands on it or anything that it sits on, closely interacts with the material, and so the electrons moving through graphene, they can't hide. They impact, they're touched by anything that is on the surface. So therefore, that holds the promise of it being a very sensitive sensor for anything that is on the surface. So if I can, it's been demonstrated, for instance, that it has a different response in how the resistance of the material changes depending upon what atoms land on the surface. You can distinguish, or molecules. You can distinguish water on the surface from ammonia or methane and so forth.
At what densities would you have to? So how many of these would, if you put one water on or one ammonia, it seems difficult that you're going to be able to distinguish. So what kind of densities do you need to be able to do that?
Not that high. You can see from one molecule landing on the surface that changes the number of electrons in graphene by just one, we can see that difference.
In the DC conductivity, or does it have to be AC?
It's actually in the DC conductivity.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
That is
it's
pretty very, amazing.
Very sensitive.
So now, how about these other materials? Because I know you're working on a particular one. Why don't you talk about that one a little? It's got a weird name. It's got a chlorine.
So I've been playing with graphene since about 2005 or 6, and it's been a lot of fun. But we've been discovering, by we, I mean, you know, kind of my community, that there are hundreds or thousands of layered materials that you might be able to pull apart just with Scotch tape. You know, of course, people started playing with these. And if there's that many of them, the question is, you know, where do you start, right? What should be really interesting? So I just happened to be at a conference a couple of years ago, and this guy got up and gave a talk about some very interesting magnetic properties in something called ruthenium trichloride. I'd never heard of this. The physics he was talking about sounded very interesting. But what caught my attention is he said, and this is a layered material. So I immediately raised my hand and I said, well, have you pulled this apart? He said, no. And I said, well, send me some. And so he did. So this ruthenium trichloride, it's a layered material. Each layer consists of ruthenium atoms and chlorine atoms. And interestingly, it bears a resemblance to graphene. The ruthenium atoms are also on a honeycomb lattice. And then you imagine that each ruthenium has kind of a little cloud of chlorine atoms around it. And it's the chlorine atoms that kind of hold all the ruthenium's together in this honeycomb. So this thing is actually an electrical insulator. It's a very good insulator. Current does not like to move through it at all. But it has some very interesting magnetic properties. And in fact, we believe that it is something called a quantum spin liquid. That's kind of a fancy sounding phrase. The idea, what I'd like you to imagine is, think of a little bar magnet. Think of a bar magnet floating in space. And now think that I've got all these bar magnets floating in space kind of in a sheet, and they're all on a honeycomb lattice. And so they can't move, but they can rotate. So if you think about how magnets like to, you know, orient kind of opposite north-south, you know, north and south kind of opposite to each other. This lattice of magnets I want you to imagine is now going to try to rotate, where everybody's going to try to pair up with all the partners near them. But if I frustrate these magnets in a way, so I prevent them from being able to reach this nice order across the entire system, then the entire behavior actually starts to look like water, where waves of rotating magnets will roll across the system. And so that's where this phrase liquid comes from, because it kind of looks like water waves moving through it. It's not actually water. It's just the rotations of all these magnets.
How do you frustrate?
How do you frustrate? It's actually intrinsically frustrated.
At a certain temperature? If you go cold enough, it's not going to be frustrated.
That's right.
Anymore.
If you go cold enough in this material, if you go cold enough, they will eventually freeze into a set shape. I should note here that kind of the holy grail of the quantum spin liquid field is to find materials that don't achieve that order as you go colder and colder and colder. This one actually does at about 7 degrees above absolute zero. But when you're warmer than that, all of these spins are fluctuating in all directions, and in some kind of spooky quantum mechanical sense, every one of these magnets feels the presence of all the others, and they're all not rotating in unison, but they're all trying to pair up with all the others across the lattice at the
same
time.
Now, there's no way that I can think of that you're going to see this spatially. So what are you looking for? You're looking for time variation in magnetization signals, or what are you looking at?
Yeah, so this is a great question. one of the main properties of a quantum spin liquid is that it doesn't seem to have any such well-defined features. By definition, it doesn't have a magnetization or a long-range order. The best thing I can say about it is that it can hold a lot of heat. It has what I'd call a high heat capacity, and so we can measure that. But that alone doesn't guarantee that you're looking at one of these quantum spin liquids. So this is actually an open question in the field. How do you prove to yourself that you're looking at a quantum spin liquid and not something else that kind of behaves in some way like this?
Now, there's a theoretical thing, and it's been done analytically and computationally, called the two-dimensional Ising model. And so are there theorists, and then that's where spins interact with their nearest neighbor according to very clear criteria. Are theorists trying to study this with some sort of modified Ising model theory?
They certainly are. So one of the reasons the quantum spin liquid is so interesting is because it is so hard to define. The idea has been around since 1973. A very smart guy named Phil Anderson came up with it.
Oh, yes.
And we've been trying to, by we I mean experimentalists, have been trying to find systems that really can realize these quantum spin liquids, while at the same time we kind of don't yet exactly know what we're looking for. So it requires a heavy theoretical component. Now, the reason I'm looking at this ruthenium trichloride material is that the specific honeycomb lattice that these magnets live on and the specific interaction between all of the magnets, between all of the atoms, is actually something that is analytically solvable. You can write down all the equations for this. You don't have to do some sort of open-ended numerical simulation. You can, with pencil and paper, write down the solution for what this system should be. And in fact, that's how it was discovered, was just some theorist, a guy named Alexei Kiteyev at Caltech, very smart guy, very nice guy, came up with this model, and he said, look at this, it's got this nifty quantum spin liquid property. And it caught people's attention, but it was such an outlandish model that no one thought you would ever be able to actually realize this in a material. few years later, some really smart cookies figured out what kind of material you would need to have to realize Kitaev's model. And there's been a red hot race on search for this stuff ever since.
So one interesting thing to me is when graphene sort of came to the fore, even though it had this very interesting sort of history pertaining primarily to its production method using Scotch tape, people started to kind of bandwagon up a little bit that was reminiscent at some level of high TC superconductivity in 86, 87, 88, somewhere in there. And everybody speculated that it was going to change the world. Now, that was limited by the class of materials as much as anything else, amazing properties, but also some limitations, primarily about them being ceramics. This seems, because there's so many different materials and so much to explore still, where the classes of materials are very different, that perhaps there's more possibility for something crazy to happen. So is there still a possibility that some craziness will occur?
Yeah, I think so. There are so many materials that we haven't even begun to look at. So the kinds of properties useful or just interesting that we're going to run into, we really don't know the limit of that yet. And I can go a bit farther and say, point out that we've developed methods that allow us to not only produce these atomically thin materials, but pick them up and stack them on top of each other. So we can make arbitrary sandwiches of layers of different materials. We can vary the thickness of each constituent layer there. We can vary the relative rotation between each layer. And every time I do a step like this, I'm somehow creating some new material that's never been seen. And the properties of each layer in these stacks might interact with each other in some way that we don't even know yet. So the overall property of the material is very likely to be, you know, greater than the sum of its parts. And that direction is really where I think we're going to go. The problem becomes enormous. We've got potentially thousands of materials that we can pull apart into single or a few layer thick materials. And then once we start putting them together in these ways, stacking and rotating and so forth, it's really just an infinity of combinations, any one of which could potentially be extremely useful, either just towards, you know, doing things that we already know we want, like better conductors or superconductors, or things we haven't even thought of yet. That's really, you know, the joy of discovery part of all of this.
Well, fortunately, WashU has hordes of graduate students to do your bidding. Is that true? I mean, you just – yes, exactly. Very
yeah.
good. Well, you know what? I think we've talked about a ton. I wanted to mention that Eric is giving a talk at Missouri State University for the Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Material Science, and that's brought our connection about a little bit. And, of course, we're exploring connections that could be furthered down the road. Eric, thanks so much for stopping by and talking about all this today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
And this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.